Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay, we were talking about pratyakshapraman, sensory perception, as a means of valid knowing. And there were subdivisions. There are six different sources of that perception. The five senses and the mind, and then the perception can be savikalpika or nivrikalpika or savikalpika. It can be a raw perception or it can be a recognized perception that's been given a name. That makes twice as many, 12 different kinds. And then pratyaksha is different according to whether it's a wise person who's perceiving it or an unwise person. 24 kinds. Okay, continuing in the text. Again, this is Jiva Goswami speaking in the Sarvasamvadini. Tatra vaiduṣe navit pratipattihi brahmadi nivi dosha rahityat shabdasyapi tanmulatvat cha kintu avaidusha eva samshayaha tadiyam gyanam hi vyabhicharati yata maya mundavalokane devadattasyaiva mundamidam vilokyate ityadau. Among these other means, the perception of the wise perceptions of the wise do not disagree. That's not right. That means that they don't disagree among one another. I don't think that's the intended idea. Vaiduṣe. In the Vaiduṣa, there's no vritti-pratti. There's no disagreement about it. Nobody disagrees. But here I'm saying perception of the wise do not disagree. Someone in the editing, something got changed here. I'm sorry. There is no disagreement about the perception of the wise. Because these perceptions are devoid of the human weaknesses such as faulty judgment. Okay, perception of the wise, we're talking about pratyaksha, sensory perception of the wise, is devoid of the four faults. So that specifies what kind of people we consider wise. People who don't have these faults. Albert Einstein, I don't think, fits the category. Or even the greatest scholars, if they're not liberated souls, are not free from the four faults, so they're not really wise. No, we're doing pratyaksha. The subdivisions of pratyaksha is the pratyaksha of the wise people, as opposed to the pratyaksha of the unwise people. Continuing, moreover, the perceptions of the wise are the basis of even verbal testimony. Shabda Praman. It doesn't mean that the sages are the authors of the Vedas, or that the Vedas are the creation of the sages. the traditional and assumed idea, the axiom is that the Vedas don't have an author, that they're not dependent on any person's authority. They have their own authority, not dependent on any person, any author, or anybody else. So what this must mean is that our perception of verbal testimony comes from the wise. It's the wise, the sages, from whom we receive the Vedas. So they're the, just like our reception of the mail depends on the mailman. We're waiting for a check in the mail. We're waiting for the mailman. And if he doesn't deliver it, or if he steals it, or fails to come with it, I don't get the check in the mail. But the check is money coming not from the mailman, but from somebody else. So the Vedas are not coming, not originating from the sages, but the sages deliver them. We'll see whether I say that in the commentary. If I don't, it should be added. In the perceptions of the foolish, however, doubt occurs. And the understanding of such unwise people can deviate from the facts. I think also that should be changed. I'm sorry, I'm making so many changes here. In the perceptions of the foolish, doubt occurs. Sounds like the foolish are having doubts. But it's, we're looking at the perception of the foolish with a critical eye, and we're finding doubts. We're having doubts. So I think better to say about than in. Sorry, I'm stopping for this, but it's important we catch anything that's questionable here. It's still, although we've done the English editing, it looks like there's still things to catch here. Philosophical things have not been all straightened out yet. In the perception, so this is not a finished manuscript, excuse me. About the perceptions of the foolish, however, doubt occurs. And the understanding of such unwise people can deviate from the facts. For example, when such a fool sees an imitation head, he may think, I see Devadatta's head. It's not. It's a you know, a plastic model or something. Imitation head. Wise person wouldn't be fooled like that. Commentary. The wise are those whose judgment is infallible, including God and his pure devotees. Srila Jiva here says that the perceptions of the wise are the basis of verbal testimony, shabda pramana, because even though the words of the Vedas are eternal, we can access them only when a reliable sage receives them in meditation and transmits them to us through a line of disciplic succession. I guess that covers it. Okay, then more text. So what we said is, is pratyaksha reliable, or infallible even? Well, it's pretty much infallible if it's coming from infallible people, their perception. But fallible people, not reliable very much at all. You have to use it, but it's not extremely reliable, or not completely reliable. Yes. Okay, go ahead.
One of those 10 kinds of pramanas was the arsha. So what's the difference between if we're saying that Shabda Praman is based upon the pratyakshara of the wise. And so what's the difference between that and Arsha?
Well, according to the Vedantists, including us, there's really only three kinds, basic kinds. And the others are just variants. They really can all be included under the three basic kinds. So Arsha is just a take on a variety of pratyaksha and, see, it's a combination of pratyaksha and shabda. the wise perceive something and then they say something. So it's a combination of the two. But it's really all based just on the first three. That's what Jiva Goswami will be saying then, I think.
Yes.
Is Devadatta just an example of the name, is it?
Of a...
of a name, of a person's name.
Yeah, Devadatta is a famous person, always comes up. He's a fictional character. He's nobody in particular.
Well, can Arsha be also like this, the six darshans? They're not all like infallible, but they're recognized as sages, as authorities on certain...
Well, okay, we're speculating about Arsha. Have you read yet what Jiva Goswami said about it? Okay, let's wait. Let's wait for that. Let's see what he says is Arsha. Okay. We're talking about Arsha is like this or like that, but we haven't even gotten the definition of it yet. Yes?
Just getting back to the definition of Shabda, it looks like, based on what Jiva Goswami says, we can meaningfully call Shabda Brahman in the ultimate sense, like Shabda Brahman, as a perception of the most perfect person, Krishna. So he's perceiving reality, and that's his, you could say, opinion about what is true, what is not true, what's real, what's not real, which is codified in the Vedas eternally. It's not that he, as you said many times, not that he sat down and wrote the Vedas down because he didn't have any Krishna or Narayana, because otherwise Vedas will take on a entirely different, separate, independent ontological status.
They don't.
Right.
You know, the Vedas emanate from Narayana. And it's not just physically emanate. He's snoring in his sleep and the Vedas come out. But also it's an expression of his intelligence, of the intelligence of the Supreme. But that's not a cause and effect relationship in time. Material cause and effect is a time relationship. It's defined in Nyaya. The definition of cause is that a cause must be present before the effect. And also a few other things. One of the conditions is it must be present before the effect. You can't call something the cause if it wasn't there before the product. It's something else. It's not the cause. So, Narayan is not the cause of the Vedas because they're co-eternal with him, not according to the material definition of cause.
Well, that's true. What we, if we talk about cause and effect relations in terms of time, then that's true. It makes perfect sense.
Well,
but if
that's the only kind of cause and effect relationships that we're capable of talking about.
In philosophy.
We, as human beings, we are limited. We can only think and talk about causes and effects within time. The causes and effects that are eternal are really beyond our understanding.
Well, for instance,
we can say emanates from Narayan. And it says that in the Upanishads. They emanate from Narayan. And we can understand their expressions of his intelligence. At the same time, we can say they have no author. Because there's no material relationship of cause and effect.
For instance, we could give the example.
Okay, one thing is we jumped right into a question session prematurely. You know, I don't think we should interrupt the what Jiva Goswami is saying so quickly. Maybe hold off. But let's deal with what you're saying. Go ahead. But then we stop the questions and hold on to them until. No, go ahead. Let's do this one. We already started.
Like we can give an example of the sun, which is oftentimes given, and the sun and the sun's rays. They're not related as a temporal cause and effect thing, because we didn't see a black sun and then all of a sudden the rays sprouted or spurted out of the sun.
Well,
we see them all together, like electric current, electric field around the current.
Well, that's what we see.
So they coexist simultaneously, but one is the basis of the other.
That's a naive perception, because there is a temporal relationship. The rays of the sun, or even the electrons that compose electricity, I mean, electricity is made up of electrons, right? They're not eternal. Electrons come and go. They go around the circuit, and even the same electrons come around again. You know, they go through the circuit repeatedly. So the rays of the sun are coming and going, you know, in time. It's not eternal rays, but it's one ray, a bunch of rays, and then another bunch of rays, and another, you know, all the time more rays are coming out. That's temporal. That's in time. They're not eternal. So there is a material cause an effect relationship between the sun and the rays that it emanates. It's emanating them in time, one after one after another.
We take sun and the sun rays as an aggregate. Like all the rays, whichever existed inside the sun, outside the sun, they coexist with the sun all the time. And
Of course, do they? Are the rays eternal?
Any analogies?
What's a sun ray? I don't know.
It's
photons. I think sort of a fiction.
It's a
that the sun rays are eternal. They're not.
Effulgence of the sun god.
They may exist in potential, but the actual rays come into being at a certain time and they go out, they are emanated into space and go to the other side of the galaxy and eventually they dissipate, I guess. I don't know whether it's a physical fact that light rays exist forever or they just sometimes just peter out. I don't know. But anyway, they do have a beginning. They may not have an end, but they have a beginning. Each one of them, each photon of light has a beginning. A time at which it was created. It didn't exist before that. There's an expenditure of energy. You know, and some other energy is converted into light energy. The sun's chemical energy, we understand it to be fusion, is a nuclear reaction. An expenditure of energy results in the emanation of light. That happens at a certain time. That light didn't exist before the fusion happened. And there are individual, molecules fusing all the time. So it's temporal. The creation of the sun rays is in time. It's a material cause and effect relationship. The sun, or let's say the nucleuses of various elements that make up the sun are the material cause of the rays of light that emanate from the sun by nuclear reaction.
Well, I give this example just to show that even in this example could be used with some caution to illustrate coexistence of things. Although if we dig deeper, of course, we'll find material causal relations. But right. In terms of transcendental objects, looks like the causal relations are not temporal, but they're like ontological. Krishna is the foundation of all existence. And
yes.
He is, not the Jivas, not the Vedas, not his energies. In other words, he eternally creates, eternally maintains, should I say, the existence of everything else around it.
By the workings of his energies, the Shakti Parinama transformations produced by Krishna's energies. Two kinds of energies, spiritual and material. So the transformations of the spiritual energies are not temporal. They're not in time and material time and space.
That's clear.
And we have to say they're eternal.
Yes.
But there are transformations of his material energy, and they're all eternal in particular time and space. They're all non-eternal. They're in particular time and space. And those are also transformations of Krishna's energy, but transformations of his material energy.
But the spiritual energy, since they're eternal, co-eternal with Krishna, they still depend or rest upon Krishna. Maybe not in time, because there is no time, but in essence.
And as described in Vedanta philosophy, as emanation.
Or like you could say, the happiness of Krishna's devotees in Vrindavan is caused by Krishna, although not in time, but in essence. He's the cause of their happiness.
Yes.
But ontologically, not temporally.
Yes.
That's what I meant to say. So Vedas also not produced.
And you're right that the analogy of the sun rays is used, but it's sort of a poetic analogy because the emanation of the rays from the sun is material. Poetically, it gives you an idea. Okay. Now let's go back to the text. Natu shabdaha. Yata himalaye himam ratnakare ratnam ityadau tat shabdenaiva badamulam yata drishta chara maya mundakena kenachit brahmat satyepi ashadadiyamane. Satyam evedam iti nabo vanyadau janan api vidopasanam vina nakinchit api tatvena nirnetum shakno titi hi sarvesham evanyaya vidam stitihi. So, pratyaksha is not fallible because okay, the pratyaksha of a liberated soul is infallible, but how do you know who's a liberated soul? So many people claims are made that so-and-so is liberated, that he's perfect. Maybe he isn't. So, in general, therefore, pratyaksha is not so infallible. Then, not so for verbal testimony. For example, in such statements as, there is snow in the Himalayas, and there are jewels in this mine. The facts are firmly established simply by the verbal statements. Or to give another example, suppose one has been deluded by seeing a person's false head and may not even believe in that person's real head. Even if he then hears a voice in the sky say, this head is real, all who know the methods of logic will confirm that without respectfully approaching his elders, he cannot correctly ascertain any truth. Okay, voice in the sky tells him it's a real head. Maybe someone, you know, faked it. Maybe that voice in the sky is a fake. So he's going to have to approach reliable authorities and ask them what's actually going on here. Yes. Okay. Let's see what the commentary says. Say a voice in the sky makes an announcement. Such testimony may be reliable evidence coming from higher authorities. Demigods, for example, may be giving the hearer beneficial knowledge. Or the testimony may be the deceptive, unreliable evidence of envious spirits intending to do harm. Or the hearer may simply be hallucinating. To be reliable, Shabda Pramana must come from a verifiable authority. The problem with voices in the sky, you don't know for sure where it's coming from. Whose voice is that? Why is it reliable? In this context, elders should be taken to refer, because the word elders, vridha, is used in the text. That should be taken to refer not merely to persons older than oneself, but rather to those who actually know more and who do not pretend to know more than they actually know. Okay. We can stop here for comments. Anything? Okay, you're first.
Well, Shabda Pramana, how it's verifiable, because looks like, since you explained yesterday, that even Shabda Pramana kind of hinges upon our pratyaksha, so we have to apply our ears and our mind and our other senses to read or hear or understand things spoken in the Vedas. Looks like, at least to me, maybe I'm wrong, please correct me, looks like those verifiable authorities should be first physically present somehow to correct our understanding in case we get off. Or second, we should accept them as such, otherwise we won't care for what they say.
Right.
Is it right?
Well, let's see. Why do they have to be physically present?
Because if we get their words wrong, like because we're still dependent on our perception, imperfect perception of the senses, even to accept Shabda Pramana from them.
Well, what
they should have the right and the facility, ability to interfere with our improper understanding and correct us.
Right.
Actively.
But can I get valid shiksha from someone who's not physically present? Suppose I never met Prabhupada, but I pick up his book and it gives me some insight about some question I am puzzling about. So haven't I gotten Shabda Pramana from someone who's not present and still it works?
But so yes, but in this case, where are Ritviks wrong, for instance? Because they also get Ritviks. What are they getting wrong? Because they also get Shabda Pramana from the same source, but they get it entirely wrong, and Prabhupada is not here to correct them.
Yes. No, but that's the Ritvik fallacy is a question of Diksha. But Shiksha can come from someone who's not present.
They misinterpret Prabhupada's words. So in other
okay,
words,
so the Ritviks are not reliable authorities on what they're saying about initiation.
I mean to say that Prabhupada is a reliable authority, of course, but when they read his books, they get it wrong.
Misinterpret Prabhupada.
If Prabhupada were here present physically, he would have corrected them, and he would let no mistake about it.
I'll agree that You need someone physically present to verify your understanding. You do need a... you can't avoid... You should not avoid having an instructing spiritual master who was there, you know, to tell you, yes, you're right, yes, you're wrong. You can read Prabhupada's book and get an idea, but how are you going to know whether your idea is right? Unless you go to a present person and get a verification. Yes.
It's a bit of a side remark, but looks like Diksha is just a check and balance system to make sure that we get Shikshup right. Looks like Diksha is a check and balance system for many other things. For one thing, yeah. It's a check and balance system to make sure that we get the Shikshup right.
Diksha is also a separate thing.
I know that.
But the Diksha, like just like when there is different contrary Shikshas coming from different persons, the Diksha Guru is the umpire. He says, listen to this one. Or it's not only above, it's this. You know, when there's apparent disagreement among authorities that you're listening to, the Diksha Guru has to settle the issue.
It's a highly important issue because now we see confirmation of this even in the works of Jiva Goswami in an indirect way, but when he talks about verifiable authority, then like people who don't accept a physically present person who is a source of Shabda Brahman, even if he just communicates it to us as a transparent medium, then they don't have any verifiable means of making sure that the Shiksha they get is right.
Yeah, suppose we listen to the Ritviks and only accept Prabhupada as a verifiable authority and nobody after Prabhupada is a verifiable authority, then what happens is we're getting all our opinions from the Ritvik. Yeah, he becomes our absolute guru. Yeah, and everything, all in one. Because we're doubting everything else. He's our only authority. You know, okay, Prabhupada's authority, but he's telling us what Prabhupada's saying. Well, he's the priest and ask this young devotee, who's your guru? He'll say, well, so-and-so gave me the diksha.
Okay, we got a few hands up. I'll get to you, but Kishore, and actually Nityananda was first. Let me Nityananda, then Kishore, then Bart Ram, and then everybody else. Nityananda, you had something?
Well, actually, I thought if you could please explain the meaning of this text once again. About the this which we read right now, and its relation to a previous text.
Okay, hold on a second. My computer wants to hibernate. And not only that, it's not doing it. Why don't we hold off on that question because I have to see the text to answer it. So. Because I don't know which statement you're referring to. Okay. Okay, you can't understand how it fits in. Well, it's saying not so for verbal testimony. That means verbal testimony... Verbal testimony is not... Hold on a second. Well, okay. About... No. There is some confusion there. What? Not so what? I think I have to change something in the text to clarify it. Let me say what should be there. Okay, I'll tell you generally, but to get it right, I'm going to have to work on it because there's some confusion there.
What are the main points made in this two figures?
Well, the main, you know, the basic point of this whole section is that the other means of knowing are fallible. And aparusheya shabda praman, shabda brahma, is not fallible. That's the main point. But here we were saying that there's two kinds of pratyaksha. We're talking specifically about pratyaksha now, analyzing the not completely reliable nature of pratyaksha. And under that heading, we're discussing that there's two kinds of pratyaksha. The pratyaksha of wise people and the pratyaksha of unwise people. And only the pratyaksha of wise people is infallible. Now, the missing statement that I should add is that we cannot always determine who's a wise person. Therefore, pratyaksha praman is fallible. Then this paragraph begins, but not so verbal testimony. Verbal testimony is not questionable in the same way as pratyaksha is. There may still be something missing there, but that's. I have to give further thought to it to make sure it's all there. Yeah, I don't. Yeah. Okay, why don't you just? Yeah, it's working. Thank you. No. We said that it's based on, and I clarified in the commentary. Not that it completely depends on it, that the pratyaksha of the wise is the origin of shabda praman. It's not. The Vedas don't have any wise people, you know, as their origin. We can't have any access to shabda praman without the help of the wise.
Vyasadeva, the Bhagavatam was revealed to him, he wrote down. So we all accept that on faith. So that's how we're receiving the Sabda Praman, by their perception.
Yes. Yeah. So, you're right.
Yeah. So it seems that...
I'm sorry, I have to deal with... I have to get this comment in here.
Yeah, so what was that last thing?
I was just saying that... That our perception of sabda comes from the perception of the wise. So
we need the help of the wise verify shabda praman. And the example is given, voice in the sky. It's a verbal testimony. Some who knows what voice is coming in the sky telling me something. But that still needs to be verified. The real Shabda Brahman has to come from a verified authority, a verifiable authority.
So our Shabda Brahman that we receive is verified by the perception of the wise?
Yes. It actually, the truth of Shabda Brahman is self-evident. But our recognizing the truth, it's not that the truth is established, that the opinion of the wise make the Vedas true, that they're true because the wise believe in them. They're true even if nobody believes in them. But it's not a question of whether the Vedas are true. It's a question of how do we know that the Vedas are true? How do we, understand that the Vedas are true? We can only understand that the Vedas are true by what the wise tell us.
And then the question arises, how can we recognize
the wise?
So there's
pramanyam, the authoritativeness of something. And there's pramanya jnana, there's a knowing the pramanya. Two different things. We can't know the authoritativeness of the Vedas without the help of the wise. But the Vedas have their authoritativeness no matter what anybody thinks or says.
question rises in the discussion, how do we perceive, I mean, how do we know who's wise or not? And I'm wondering if this next section is speaking about this. This next comment of Jiva
Goswami. I don't think so. Now, let's go back. What did you say just now?
Rises, how do we recognize the wise from the not wise?
Well, okay, but
you,
I know, but I don't know. I don't know that that's being discussed here.
Okay.
In the previous sentence, that may be in the previous passage, that may be implied, but I have to look at it carefully. Okay. And to answer your question, let me look at this statement. Beginning, not so for verbal testimony. This doesn't discuss the problem of how do you know who is wise. It just says you got to go to someone who is wise. So it looks like your question about how do you know who is wise is not, at least not yet, brought out. Okay? Yeah, but the problem of how do you know who is wise, that may not be dealt with here. Okay? Let's see. Let's go on further. Yes.
Maybe this is the case like when Srila Rupa Goswami, Shrinanda Goswami gave their books to edit to Srila Jiva Goswami. They are themselves ultimate authority, they are wise themselves and they received knowledge from above. But then they gave it to edit somebody who is also reliable. In this connection. So,
yes.
For example, if you have somebody like one who is himself Diksha Guru, Acharya for many followers, and he had received some knowledge, Vedic knowledge, so what should he do with this knowledge? Because here is advised that he has to go to some wise to confirm whether this knowledge is reliable or not.
Okay, I'm a little confused now. Just the last part about...
Yeah.
So Shiksha Guru, who has to go? The disciple or the guru?
Somebody who is himself authority for many followers, like Acharya.
Okay, so we have someone who's an authority, yes.
Acharya, he received knowledge in meditation and some Vedic knowledge. So should he go and confirm this knowledge from somebody
who is he?
Else?
That authority or his followers?
Because he may not have anybody.
Okay.
around him to confirm it. So what should he do in this case?
He, you mean the authority?
Yeah, authority.
Well, before you become an acharya, before you become an authority, telling other people what the philosophy is, you should have assimilated it properly. How do you have know the right answers to the questions? You should have done that before you set yourself up as an authority. You should have heard from your gurus, and studied the books, and answered and raised questions about your doubts and settled everything. It's not that ad hoc after you become guru you start finding answers to the questions. You should have pretty much the questions answered before. And it's the same process. The disciples of the new authority are going to find out what's what from Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu, from the books and from the authority. By consulting the books and asking the authority to clarify the books, they're going to get a correct idea. Now, how did the authority get his ideas right? By the same process previously.
But, for example, if he receives some new knowledge which he didn't know before, or
okay, something new.
Yeah, something new. Yeah. So and he himself not sure that this is a real knowledge. He received it in his meditation.
Then or maybe saw it in a book, or someone told him something new. Then he has to judge it, the new idea, according to the basic understanding that he's received from his gurus. Now his gurus aren't around anymore, and he's supposed to be the guru. then he has to just judge the new idea according to the old ideas. You know, you've studied the Gita, you've studied the Bhagavatam, you've had them explained to you by your gurus. Now when you get a new idea to consider, and you're supposed to say whether the idea is right or wrong, you have to compare it, you have to judge it according to what you've learned before. The Bhagavatam should tell us enough to be able to verify any idea. Any idea coming from somewhere else can be verified or rejected according to what the Bhagavatam says. The Bhagavatam answers all questions. Bhagavatam especially as properly understood from a guru. So when you properly understood the Bhagavatam from a guru, you'll be able to deal with all new ideas as they come and judge them properly. Just according to what the Bhagavatam said and what the guru said about the Bhagavatam.
Asking this question because I remember a story about Jayadeva Goswami in his Gita Govinda when he received this knowledge about how Krishna is bowing down before Srimati Radharani, and he didn't hear it before, he didn't read it in any books, and no sages spoke about
Jiva Goswami?
No, Jayadeva Goswami.
Jayadeva Goswami.
And then he was in hesitation whether it's right or wrong, and he went to take bath in Ganges, and Krishna himself, he came and he confirmed it, that this is right.
So yes.
It may be the case, but for example...
Did he go to anybody to verify it, or just...
Yeah.
Did he? Did he check with anybody?
I don't think so.
Okay. You know, he's in a different sampradaya.
Yeah.
So that the method of just getting your information directly from Radharani may be valid for him, but we're in a different sampradaya. We're a little more orthodox. We don't even know. You cannot identify Jayadeva Goswami sampradaya. So he's not in our sampradaya because he's before Lord Chaitanya. In our sampradaya, we're even more conservative. If Srimati Radharani tells you something, still you go to your guru to verify it.
Anyway,
yes.
So we can assume that Krishna may also himself intervene, and he may also make some hints or some confirmation in such a difficult situation.
As Super Soul, he does it, with everybody.
As Super Soul, or he may arrange something so that it would be evident for everybody that this revelation which was received is correct.
Yeah, Krishna can send a sign or something, or a voice in the sky, or something written on stone or something. Yes. But even that, better to go to the wise and verify even that. You know, Krishna came to me and told me this. Well, go to my guru and make sure I wasn't hallucinating. I think Krishna came to me and told me something. Can I accept it? And, still should go to the guru and get verification.
And in the case of ISKCON, for example, if somebody of our spiritual masters or of our senior devotee, he receives some knowledge, so he just has to go to some other senior Vaishnavas and ask them for confirmation.
Yes. Then the other Vaishnava serves as Shiksha Guru. The etiquette is you should take permission from the Diksha Guru to go to other Shiksha Gurus. Because he's your Shiksha Guru too. So he's your first Shiksha Guru. So you ask his permission before going to another one.
But in the case of ISKCON Guru, Srila Prabhupada already left, he's not there.
Well, so, then Prabhupada is... We know Prabhupada's desire is that we take instruction from our other devotees in ISKCON. That we don't go outside of ISKCON. So we can take anybody in ISKCON whose understanding is not distorted and accept him as Shiksha Guru. And we shouldn't go and get Shiksha Gurus outside of ISKCON.
So it's okay that we go to somebody in ISKCON and ask for confirmation for our revelation?
Yes.
Okay.
There may be devotees who are connected to ISKCON but are having philosophical problems because of emotional problems or spiritual problems, their judgment may be distorted. So you can't go to necessarily just anybody, but you can find somebody. Yes.
So we saw in this example that that person was not able to believe that voice from the above. So that is one case of a pratyaksha being doubtful. So to what degree that we should doubt our perception, that we should every time go and confirm with the voice?
Well, is that, I'm confused here. Is this voice in the sky example an example of prajaksha or of shabda? It's someone saying something, so that's shabda praman. So we're dealing with the voice in the sky as prajaksha? Okay, I think I have to clarify that. I'm sorry, let me make another note here. Hold on a second, I'm sorry I have to take a second to write this. I want to clarify, I want to add something to the commentary, that the voice in the sky is pratyaksha. Depends on who speaks. What do you mean? Then it's projection.
He gave the first example as the person sees the cut head. That is a perception through eyes. And I think the next he is giving a perception through ears, that he hears some voice from top, and then maybe the different senses he gives some examples.
Okay. I'm just going to have to think about this. I can't tell you for sure. I'm still a little doubtful whether it actually is projection. So it looks like shabda praman is, you hear a voice, you're hearing someone's opinion. So the opinion of a reliable authority is shabda praman. The only thing is, it hasn't been verified as reliable.
Yeah.
So, okay.
So you said yesterday...
Is it?
Shabda is the apta vakya. So
but the question is, the voice in the sky is not necessarily apta.
Yeah, so we don't know whether it's not shabda praman.
Okay, so yes, it's not established as shabda praman yet. But that's what we're saying here, is that to be reliable, shabda praman must come from verifiable authority. That means what I perceive, the statement by someone that I perceive, becomes shabda praman when I verify who said it is reliable.
So that means like perception through ears becomes shabda when it is verified.
Yes. Yes.
But perception through other sense organs, not necessarily. That's why we give more focus on hearing. Is that...
Perception by other senses is not...
It's not...
Not verifiable in the same way?
No, in a sense, we say shabda means the sound. So perception through ears, when it is verified, becomes shabda pramana.
But perception, other perceptions too. If I think I see something. You know, I was on Parakram and I thought I saw Krishna and the cowherd boys. That's a perception, my perception. Now I go to my guru and say, you know, I think I saw this, and he'll tell me, well, it was real, or no, it wasn't real. So his testimony about it, his opinion about it, is shabda praman. So it's the same with other senses also, not just hearing, seeing and other senses also.
My initial question was in this only. Suppose if he is getting perception through eyes and he is getting some knowledge, so to what degree that he should trust his perception and to what degree he should go and ask?
Not that this is being discussed here, but it is discussed elsewhere. What the senses tell you is in normal situations reliable. As long as your senses are not... as long as they're in working order, you're not sick or some other distortion of the senses, then what they tell you about ordinary things is generally reliable. When we're talking about things that are beyond their scope, then their reliability fails, because we're going beyond their scope. Talking about things that we can't actually perceive, the perception points us toward something, but we can't definitely perceive. But within their scope, senses are reliable, dealing with ordinary things, as long as they're in working order. So shabda praman has its reliability, but it's not complete and absolute.
So this scope is defined by case by case basis, right?
By?
By case by case basis, like for
well, they're individual. General principles. You know, you can study scientifically what the capacity of your senses are, what things they can perceive. Scientists, you know, biologists and psychologists study these things. So you can have some scientific idea about the scope of the senses. Within that scope, they're basically reliable.
In the sentence, it says, not so for verbal testimony.
I know, that's a question. Not so what?
Yeah.
I have to clarify that. I have to think about it. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. Suggest.
The last statement, the last text said, the understanding of such unwise people can deviate from the facts. So I think
Well, that's unwise projection.
Yeah, but he says, not so for verbal testimony. It means the verbal testimony doesn't deviate from the facts.
So it's not...
Maybe.
It's not like... It's not like...
It is along
not
the
like avaidusha pratyaksha.
Yeah, means the verbal testimony goes along with the facts. Because this is the only thing it can negate from the last statement.
So it's not like that particular kind of pratyaksha. The pratyaksha coming from unwise people.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
This is the only thing I could think it could relate to.
The problem with unwise perception, the perception of unwise people is that it's unreliable in general. And Shabda Pramana is not unreliable. Now, my doubt is, well, what does this paragraph have to do with that? We're talking about having to verify the voice in the sky. What does that have to do with it? What's the connection? What's the connection then? With having to verify voice in the sky. I'm sorry, I got to do some clarification here.
Can it be that not so for verbal testimony is the last sentence of the previous paragraph, and now you're starting another idea?
Yes. Yes, that's probably it. Problem then is, what does the rest of this paragraph have to do with it?
But then we can see if it goes with the next paragraph.
Okay, I guess. I have to look at it. A little closer. Okay. Anything else? I mean, these are questions I still have to think about. It's not settled yet, so I can't. Do you have any other problems? Yeah. But go ahead.
Oh, there was one question which came about identifying the wise. Who is the wise?
Well, okay, but Jiva Goswami doesn't say anything about that.
Yeah, but I think Prabhupada said, I remember from what Prabhupada was saying, that you should know something. It's self-evident, who is wise.
Yes.
And something should be known. If a person knows absolutely nothing, then he cannot find somebody who is wise.
So if you have some knowledge, you can find someone who has more knowledge. You can identify.
About who is wise also.
If you have some common sense, you should be able to identify who is wise. Yeah, okay, yes. Yes,
sir. Regarding definition, who is wise, probably we should refer to the principle of Guru Parampara, because, there is a principle of mathematical induction. So first we make some statements which are true, verifiably so, and then by induction we also project them into the whole realm of statements. Same as Krishna is the original source of all sampradayas.
Yes.
He makes sure that the closest, you could say, followers of his, the ones who are like Brahma, Lakshmi, Kumaras and Rudra, they get this knowledge right.
Yes.
So by the mere fact of a person's belonging to an authorized parampara, we may state with 99% of probability that the person is wise because he has been accepted by his guru, he has been verified and trained by him, and the guru has already checked and ascertained that the person has the knowledge and has gotten right, and he can communicate it properly to the other people.
I think the way it works is when you're a newcomer, you haven't joined the Sampradaya yet, you don't know what the Sampradaya is about, you accept somebody as an authority. Just like the early devotees accepted Prabhupada. They didn't know anything about anything, but they accepted Prabhupada. Then Prabhupada told them, there's a succession. of authorities. He is the authorities. Krishna speaks the Gita. Vyasadeva writes, you know, gives us the Bhagavatam. And here's our acharyas. They're our authorities. And I'm representing them. So we accepted all that. We got an understanding of what the parampara is because we accepted it from Prabhupada. Now you've entered ISKCON. Either one of the original members or you come later on and you're told the same thing that Prabhupada said. What happens now? Okay, I understand what the parampara is. These are our authorities, scriptural authorities and acharyas. What if someone new comes around? Or one of the devotees who are a disciple of Prabhupada, I consider whether he's a reliable, whether I can accept him as a guru, shiksha guru. How do I decide to add someone onto the parampara? I have to see it with not my naive intelligence, but now that I'm a member of the Sampradaya and I've learned quite a few things, by spiritual teaching, I have to use all my intelligence and all the knowledge I've acquired to use my own intelligence to decide, does so-and-so follow and agree with the established authorities? This new person that I may also accept him as authority, is he in agreement? Is he faithful to the parampara? If he is, okay, I'll add him to the list. But that you have to decide.
There's a brilliant statement in the commentary on the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, which your team collaborated. It's 11.2.35. It's extremely important in my opinion. It says here that... Can I read the small paragraph here?
Yes.
May I read that small paragraph?
You can read
here?
It. But then we'll have to wrap up after that. And, Bart Ram has a comment, but that's it. We'll have to stop.
Your team says here that the disciples of Srila Prabhupada in 11.2.35, it says, and therefore it is very important to understand the stated here that spontaneous revelation by the Lord within the heart is meant not to alter the eternal process of devotional service to the Lord, but to give a supplementary facility to a sincere devotee who is ignorant of revealed scriptures. In other words, the revealed scriptures describe the eternal process of service to the Lord. Since the Lord is eternal and the living entity is eternal, the process of their love and relationship is also eternal. The Lord never changes his essential nature, nor does the living entity. Therefore, there is no need to change the essential process of love and service to the Lord. Special revelation by the Lord is meant to give scriptural knowledge by another means and not to contradict scriptural knowledge. That's what it is.
Yes.
In other words, even revelation should fit into the context. It looks like in many cases, like Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur, in his own case, he couldn't rest at peace. He couldn't be peaceful. He was even at the verge of committing suicide because he couldn't find the scriptural reference for that particular statement in Chaitanya Charitamritam to understand properly how the 24 and a half syllables are supposed to be true. And the same probably goes for all other literatures of the Goswami. Somehow in that vast body of Vedic knowledge there should be some confirmation, but since we have limited scope of knowledge and limited time, limited life, limited access, we may just be given mercifully by Krishna and by the previous acharyas a particular shortcut to that knowledge without going through the tedious process of finding it by ourselves. But that has to be verifiable. We just take it on the strength of their words, their statements. But they belong to parampara. That's why we don't doubt their statements.
Tedious process. We might accomplish it with Krishna's help, but it's much easier if you've got someone you can go to who you can rely on and ask the questions. That simplifies the process and speeds it up. Thank you. You had something?
Yeah, about the same thing of identifying the wise, that they need to know something before. So if they go to the person, and if they have, it's like it's easy to see that if the person claims to be able to guide them spiritually to perfection, and if his character is questionable, then there is inconsistency in what he's claiming and what he is. So even if they don't know about parampara and stuff like that, if a person just comes and produces some ashes and says that I can really solve So, it, like, as Prabhupada used to say, this world is the world of cheaters and cheated. So, people who go to unwise people, they want to cheat themselves. And when they get the theory, what that person is proposing, when they know that they are not satisfied with that, but if they still give themselves to such a such a unsatisfactory thing, then yes, they're cheating themselves. They want to cheat themselves.
They do, yes.
They know that they're not going to a wise person.
They should be warned. The person who is in danger of accepting an unreliable authority should be informed of what he's of his danger. You know, it's our fault if we don't inform him. If we don't let the naive people know that they have to be discriminating. But once we've warned them and they go ahead, it's their fault.
Yeah, but even virtuous people, we see that they would not be satisfied. Like, you can't get a genuine person go to some stupid person who is pretending.
Right, if you got a virtuous person. But most of the world, there aren't many virtuous people. Yeah. Yes, a virtuous person has common sense. But unfortunately, most of the people in the world are not virtuous. They have to be saved too. Okay, one last thing.
About this question of who's wise, it looks like Jiva Goswami at the beginning of at section B here actually gives us the key to figure it out. He says, yes. Tatra vairushe na vipratipatihi brahmadi nridosha rahityat. So like the...
That's the definition of who's wise.
Yeah, that somebody who's devoid of the four faults, beginning of Brahma.
Okay, but don't you have a problem? How do you know these four faults?
Yeah, and it's pretty tough. I mean, karana pateva, if you get a material body, then maybe, you know, weakness of the senses may...
Somebody may look like he doesn't make mistakes, but maybe I'm just not seeing the mistakes he's making.
Yeah, that's another question in itself, how to judge if they're free from the four faults.
Well, okay, we practically do it by having a parampara, and our primary authority is the parampara, and our shastras, the Gita and Bhagavatam. And accepting anybody else's authority has to be by verifying that they're faithful to our primary authorities. That's how we know who's wise. Because we know the acharyas in our line are wise, and the opinions of the Bhagavatam and the Gita are wise, and if someone else agrees with them, then maybe they're wise also. That's practically our method. Yes.
It seems now what's like in a position in ISKCON, can we accept Prabhupada?
How about if I turn this off? Okay, what? You mean it's sitting in front? I'm sorry, the problem is sitting in front of the.
Yeah, it's a simple thing. You put the microphone.
Okay, you got to keep the microphone not in front of the amplifier. Keep the microphone a little to the side. Maybe we should do that. Is it the speakers or the amplifier? Okay. But don't put the microphone right in front.
So it seems that we accept Prabhupada's authority as wise, but now it seems many people are doubting sometimes the guru. Like I remember somebody saying, so his guru told him to do something. So I said, oh, so why don't you do that? What he said. He says, oh, he's not a pure devotee.
Oh, really?
So
that means you have weak faith in your guru.
And it seems that some people in the past, they accepted their guru as infallible, and they saw that he fell down.
Okay.
So now there's a question of, okay, how much can we accept their opinion, because are they infallible or not?
In that case, when someone who you accepted as your guru proves not to be completely reliable, then you've got to go to someone else. You gotta go to another shiksha guru, who can verify things for you. If you think that you can't, you know, your guru is no longer able to verify everything for you, then you have to go find another verifier. You can't be left in a vacuum. You got to find someone you can trust.
The benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, yeah. You give all respect to the guru, but I'm not saying to reject him or to deny everything he says. But if you have doubts, then you find someone else who can help you settle the doubts. Without rejecting, without refusing. Just refusing the guru on the grounds that he's not a pure devotee is a breach of all etiquette.
Yeah.
You know, you may be technically true that, okay, he's not a pure devotee, therefore what he says may be wrong. But it displeases Krishna if you do that, even if he is wrong. To just refuse to follow him without really good grounds and someone that reliable telling you to do that. But you just deciding, I don't need to listen to him because he's imperfect. That's not your business, and it dissatisfies Krishna.
Thank you.
Okay, we have to stop now. Thank you, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Sri Tattva Sandarbha Ki Jai.